Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I continue discussing the story of Symposia. And today, specifically, we're going to be talking about the violation of journalistic ethics on the part of Symposia and Russell Hausfeld, and really the entire Symposia team, because I do know that you guys work as a team. Even though Russell's the one who put his name on the video, I know you all work as a team, so really applies to all of you. And I'm going to provide some more context, which of course Symposia has itself failed to do, which is why I'm spending so much time here in the podcast doing that. But before we get into all of that, I have been remiss. I have not thanked people who have given donations to the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast over the past few weeks because I've been a little preoccupied with the whole Symposia story. So I would like to just say thank you to James, Brian, Brooke, Wes, and Nathan, all for making contributions to the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. If you would like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Just go by my webpage, martinball.net, use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or you can also choose to join me over at Patreon and become a patron and a monthly contributor and get access to other special features via Patreon. Also, just to let you know, there is a panel discussion in the works. As of the time that I am recording this, the date and time has not yet been set, but it will involve myself, members of Symposia, and also members of the Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society, who were the producers of the original 2.5 hour long video, which Symposia and Russell edited down to 11 minutes and then mixed with some other stuff as well. So that potentially is happening this week. Again, as of my recording this, the date and time is not set, so don't know when that's going to be happening, but I'll, of course, post on my Facebook page and let people know as soon as I know the details on that so that you can join in and hear what Symposia has to say for themselves. If you've been listening to my podcast here, you obviously know what I have to say for myself. If you listened to the interview that I did with Rob on Adeptus Psychonautica, which I'm still planning to post here on this podcast, then you also know what I have to say for myself. And as much as Symposia wants to keep coming back to, but you said these things, you did these things, and wants to remove themselves as quote-unquote part of the story, I think we all know that that is simply not true. And by saying I think we all know, I mean you guys over at Symposia as well. You're just in denial if you think you are not part of the story. You have made yourselves part of the story by your methods, by your intentions, and by your practices. And that is all quite obvious to most observers. So as much as you want to say, oh, but Martin, you said these things, no one's denied that. I certainly have not denied anything. And I've addressed all of that. Probably not to your satisfaction because, well, I don't know. Because you guys won't come on my podcast and talk to me. So I don't really know how you defend yourselves, how you explain your own behavior. And that's why I'm spending so much time on this podcast talking about it. And of course, the invitation has been open for a representative of Symposia to come on this podcast. It's been an open invitation. I've invited Russell. And, you know, you guys have responded with, we will not engage with you on your platform. Well, fine, but I'm still going to keep talking about you guys. And I'm going to keep talking about the issue of your lack of ethics. So, just to give a couple highlights here. You know, again, I'm actually not all that familiar with Symposia. And I'm not inclined to do you the favor of looking at too much of your materials. Because from what I've seen, I'm fairly disgusted by your practices. That you guys seem to be operating kind of like a pack of rabid dogs, where you just go after anyone that you feel is a good target, and anyone who might speak out against you or criticize you immediately becomes a target. And they don't even have to speak out against you. They just are just people who are expressing their own view about your work and the news, quote unquote, that you put out into the world. You immediately attack them. You seem intent on destroying people's reputations, of dragging people through the mud, and painting anyone who might dare to speak out against Symposia and your very obvious methods and intentions, and do what you can to destroy them. We have already numerous examples just with this issue around what you have put out there about me. Again, I haven't looked into all the rest of the smear campaigns that you guys have engaged in, but I know that there's a lot of them, that the word on the street is that a lot of people in the psychedelic community are really disgusted with you guys. And also a lot of people are afraid of you. They're afraid of what you are going to do to them if they dare speak out. So you are not in any way cultivating the free and open exchange of ideas or open communication and dialogue. You're actually creating a really hostile environment in which people are fearful. And maybe you're proud of that. I don't know. You won't come on my podcast to talk about it. So I don't know how you justify that to yourselves. But just in the case of me, Joseph Barsuglia made some comments, and apparently you immediately went after him. Sheree Godassi made some comments, and you immediately went after her. Rob interviewed me for his podcast, and you immediately went after him. So you guys are cultivating a culture of attack. You're cultivating a culture of fear. And again, I don't know how you justify that. So for the record, everyone, just so you know, Symposia Inc. is registered as a nonprofit public charity in the state of Rhode Island. And charities are required to abide by ethical standards, which Symposia is in clear violation of in many regards. So if anyone would like to register a complaint, or if you have been the victim of an orchestrated attack by Symposia, you can make a complaint with the Rhode Island Attorney General. And you can look up their information on charitynavigator.org, listed as Symposia Inc. So, another one of your victims, someone else that you have smeared in the past, was kind enough to provide me with a link. That's so easy, the internet, it's so great. And this was a link to standards for journalistic ethics, in particular in regard to investigative journalism, which again, this is what Russell Hausfeld, who put his name on the original Symposia video as his own production, also with the name Symposia, but he put his name at the end of it. And as you guys know from two podcasts ago, I had all kinds of questions for Russell regarding that video and kind of what their decision-making process was, whether he felt that was exemplary of the highest standards of investigative journalism ethics. And of course, I've received zero response to any of those questions. I'm going to provide you guys here now, the audience, with these are some of the guidelines for investigative journalism ethics. I myself have never taken a class on journalism. I have not investigated investigative journalism before, so I'm certainly no expert in this field. But I have highlighted a number of things that are listed as the ethics for investigative journalism. And I think that there are clear violations of pretty much all of these. So I'm going to kind of go through them one by one. And also, just kind of frame it with the idea that Russell produced this video. Well, Symposia produced the video. Again, Russell put his name on it. He lists himself in his bio as having a degree in investigative journalism. So supposedly, he should be abiding by these ethical guidelines and concerns. And if we just take the video in and of itself, understanding that it's on YouTube, and most people, I would imagine, I guess I'm just guessing here, but I would imagine that most people who are exposed to that video are simply watching that video, not necessarily reading the article for which it was originally produced, which even there is kind of ironic that the article itself that was written was about Mark Hayden, yet the majority of the article was actually about me. So I was used as a means to smear Mark Hayden by guilt by association, essentially. Because when it came to the production of the book, Manual for Psychedelic Guides, by Mark Hayden, and other authors as well, that the Symposia knew full well that none of this information, none of these ideas, none of these techniques, none of these methods were in any way promoted or discussed within the book in and of itself, that it, my talk at UCLA 5 years ago had nothing whatsoever to do with Mark Hayden or his book. But they used that because Mark Hayden was already a target of Symposia. And Symposia targets people and likes to bring them down and smear their reputations and essentially make life difficult for their targets. So the video itself, of course, first of all, was clearly and obviously was mislabeled, clearly just by the title in and of itself, which the original title that Russell or Symposia, whoever wants to take credit for it, take credit for it, but Russell put his name on it as, quote, Advice for Psychedelic Therapists by Martin Ball. I believe that that was the original title. Might have been Psychedelic Guides. Which is not at all what the original talk was. So there's mislabeling from the very beginning. So now with all that in mind, again with the idea that people are just going to be exposed to this video and not necessarily the larger context in which it was produced or even what the original context was, and for the fact that actually four different videos were mixed together into one, we can now go through this list of journalistic ethics. So, part one. Here's where I think we see a obviously clear violation. Provide context. Take special care not to misrepresent or oversimplify in promoting, previewing, or summarizing a story. The video provides no context. It is obviously an oversimplification. And again, it's connected to the larger story of their hit piece against Mark Hayden, but the video itself provides zero context. As I said two podcast episodes ago, it was clearly the product of weaponizing manufactured outrage. It's just obvious by the way that the video was made, with no context. Number two, gather, update, and correct information through the life of a news story. I think a big part of this news story, of course, is Symposia itself. They have made themselves part of the news story, yet they are in denial of that, quite clearly. Identify sources clearly. The video, in and of itself, does not identify any of the sources of the four different videos that were mixed together into one. There is no identification of sources whatsoever in the video in and of itself. If you watch the video, it says Symposia, and it has the title, and then has 11 minutes of remixed material, and then ends with Russell Hausfeld. There is no identification of sources within the original video. Diligently seek subjects of news coverage and allow them to respond to criticism or allegations of wrongdoing. Now, here in my case, it's actually Symposia that are making the allegations of wrongdoing. And yes, they sent me some initial questions from Russell, which I responded to, and I gave him a lot more materials as well, and made some suggestions for him there, and they have not really, and if going back to gather, update, and correct information through the life of a news story, I don't think they've done any updates on their end. You know, prior to the release of this video, it was known by Symposia that this was the discussion of practices that I did in the past from which I was retired and for which I did my best to give full information around with all of my potential clients. They didn't include any of that information, right? So they are not really authentically allowing me to respond to their allegations against me, and that they intentionally left out information that they were provided with. So they're not really doing their job, if we're following journalistic ethics. Provide access to source material when it's relevant and appropriate. Well, I think that in the production of this video, that mentioning the sources and providing access to it, because, you know, something that they could have done, this would have been quite easy. They could have written their article about Mark Hayden, and then they could have said, here are sections that we find concerning in this talk by Martin Ball from Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society from 2016. Here are the timestamps. Here's a link to the video. They could have done that, but no, they chose to make a highly sensationalized, highly edited video. Support the open and civil exchange of views, even views they find repugnant. Here, this is where they are in very clear violation. They do not support the open and civil exchange of views. Symposia, you guys work like a gang. You obviously gang up on people online. You immediately turn your lens onto anyone who might criticize you or question you, and then you create hit pieces about them. That is not supporting the open and civil exchange of views, even views they find repugnant. It's the complete opposite of that. How do you justify that? It's a good question. You have been invited on this podcast. I support the open and civil exchange of views. You're welcome to come and talk about any of this, but you've declined. So, avoid stereotyping. Journalists should examine the ways their values and experiences may shape their reporting. So you want to stereotype. For example, with me, what you're trying to do is stereotype me as, oh, well, look, he's anti-Semitic. Oh, look, he's a sexual abuser. Oh, look, he's bad. So, and this is what you've done to pretty much everybody you write an article about, is you are using trigger words and classifications without getting into any of the nuance or the complexity or anything else, you just write hit pieces about people. You like to take people down, and in doing that, you're stereotyping them. And clearly, your own values and experiences are shaping your reporting. That also is obvious. You are not coming from a neutral, objective position in any way. You are coming with an ideological mission and intent, which is obvious. And again, this is why you are just as much a part of the story as anything else. Label advocacy and commentary. That one seems pretty obvious. Here's a great one. Never deliberately distort facts or context, including visual information. I'd love to hear your defense of that one. Never plagiarize. Always attribute. You know, this goes back to identifying sources clearly. Provide access to source materials. You guys made a video where you mixed four different videos together, and you didn't say what the sources were. That essentially is plagiarism. You used two of my own videos in there. You used my own work that I myself produced and put out. That's plagiarism. Because you don't even say where it comes from. You're not providing your audience with the proper context and information. You are in violation of journalistic ethics. This is obvious. This is clear. I would love to hear your defense of it. Here's a good one. Balance the public's need for information against potential harm or discomfort. Pursuit of the news is not a license for arrogance or undue intrusiveness. Man, you guys are obviously in violation of that one. You are out for blood. You attack anyone who expresses any kind of criticism or opposing view to yours. That is arrogance. That is intentionally creating harm. Again, to use a phrase that I used from two podcast episodes ago, you are weaponizing manufactured outrage. Your clear intent is to do harm. I think that's obvious. If you don't, well, come on my podcast. Let's talk about it. And this, of course, relates to the very last one that I've highlighted here. Show compassion for those who may be affected by news coverage. I don't know where the compassion is in the work that you guys are doing and what you're putting out. I don't see it. Maybe you feel it's compassionate. I don't know. I don't see it. So here are a number of areas where Symposia as a whole, and Russell Hausfeld in particular, because you put your name on the video, are in clear violation of journalistic ethics. So how do you justify that? How do you rationalize that? And as a public charity, it's your obligation to uphold these ethics, yet you're in clear violation of them. So, open question, Symposia. Lots of open questions there. All right. So I think that those are all relevant points. I think that they're all important. And I think that they all easily demonstrate why Symposia is just as much a part of the story as myself, as Mark Hayden, as Brad Adams, and Paul Lissy from Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society. You guys are part of the story. And that's why I keep talking to you guys here on my podcast. All right. So now I'm going to do the job that Symposia won't do, and I'm going to provide some more context around my own practices and experiences. So, Symposia, thank you for the opportunity and the inspiration to do so. Now, I know you guys have made a big deal over me vomiting, purging on a couple of my clients. As I've explained, it only happened a couple times. Yeah, it's extreme. I've acknowledged that. It's terribly unusual. I acknowledge that. And I've also contextualized it with the times that it happened, the people that it happened to did not feel violated. They actually were grateful because weird stuff happens in some of these sessions. And so it was never an issue. And I have freely and openly shared that information. So anyway, I just thought it might be worthwhile to spend a little bit more time talking about vomiting in general, since you guys are very interested in the topic, apparently. So now I'm starting to read from page 94 of my book, Entheogenic Liberation, Unraveling the Enigma of Non-Duality with 5-MeO-DMT Energetic Therapy. Here on page 94, we have our section on purging. So here are some things that I have to say about purging. No one likes to vomit. Yet, this is an integral part of non-dual therapy with entheogens. As with other issues being discussed here, vomiting and purging has no particular metaphysical, spiritual, or other purpose other than releasing, expressing, and transforming energy. As such, it is a practical result of working with energy and clearing out the energetic system that is the human body and being. It is not about removing nebulous and ill-defined toxins from the body, which is a popular trope in spiritually minded and psychedelic circles. It is also not about cleansing the astral body or chakras or any other such metaphysical esoterica. If it helps, think of it this way. Your body, as an energetic vehicle, gets clogged and backed up due to choices made via the ego that censor and edit your natural expression of energy. Failure to be authentic, a defining feature of living in the prison of the ego, results in incompletely processed energy. Entheogens can help clean out and reset the system. It's just that simple. There is no need to introduce speculative metaphysics or spiritual interpretations of such events. Purges are a natural and necessary part of working with high-level energy experience afforded by entheogenic intake. While some entheogens, such as ayahuasca and peyote, have a clear reputation for purging and vomiting, any psychedelic holds the potential for such, given that they all work on the human system at a direct energetic level. With 5-MeO-DMT, while not everyone vomits or purges every time, anyone who seriously engages with 5-MeO-DMT for the purpose of overcoming the confines of the ego will eventually vomit. Everyone has stuck and incompletely processed energy that they carry with them in their bodies. It's part of being human. Getting it grounded out is a fundamental aspect of the process of moving toward liberation and authentic being. Before you can live authentically, you've got to clear the crap out, and there's no way around it. And you'll feel better, tremendously better, the moment you let it all go and it comes pouring out of you. With 5-MeO-DMT, there are a few distinct times that purging is most likely, and there are also several distinct forms of purging. Because purging is likely, though not universally present, sessions with 5-MeO-DMT should always be accompanied with supplies for cleanup and containment. If a mat is being used for clients to lie down on for their session, waterproof covers are highly recommended. There should also be a bucket or large bowl available, as well as towels and tissues. In some instances, clients who are prone to purging are encouraged to bring an extra set of clothes to their session, as a complete change of wardrobe may be necessary. Ideally, showers should also be available. It's not often that someone gets so messy that they need a post-session change of clothes and a shower, but it does happen, so best to be prepared. The first kind of vomiting to take note of is what we can affectionately call the champagne cork. This tends to be the messiest and most explosive form of purging that takes place with 5-MeO-DMT and occurs almost immediately after a client has taken a hit of the medicine. What's happening is that the client is energetically ready to go very deep into the experience, perhaps even fully into non-dual absorption. But before this can happen, there is an energetic blockage that needs to be expressed. In the full non-dual state, there is nothing that is rejected. But due to the ego, humans carry around all kinds of ideas and beliefs about good and bad, right and wrong, worthy and unworthy, and things that are acceptable versus things that are unacceptable. Before moving into a state of full acceptance and universal unconditional love, some individuals need to encounter, accept, and release their judgments about themselves and reality in general. This is what is taking place during the champagne cork purge. As the individual is releasing from the confines of the ego and dying into God, awareness of an aspect of themselves that they've tried to deny or reject may suddenly arise. But in passing into a state of universal love, there is no longer a need to hide the shame or judgment away, and there's also no need to hold on to it. Thus, it comes right out of the body in the form of a massively explosive purge. Yet, because the client is moving into a state of unconditional love, the most common reaction is for individuals to scoop up the vomit in their hands and smear it over themselves or even roll around in it. It's messy, but profoundly beautiful in its own way. You can literally see someone find love and acceptance for something that they previously held as disgusting, shameful, unworthy, sinful, etc., and embrace and accept it in a state of absolute love. Such events tend to be deeply and profoundly healing for people and moves them into deep acceptance of themselves and the world in a way that nothing else can. In some rare instances, clients might need to go through a similar process with other bodily excretions such as feces. It's uncommon, but it does happen. Because such vomiting happens so rapidly, it is often wise to have a towel placed immediately in front of the client, as there isn't enough time to grab a bowl. Also, a towel can be located at the head of the client's mat, as they may take a hit, lie back, and then immediately vomit. In such cases, most people receive benefit from wallowing in their vomit for a while, so no attempt should be made to clean it up, or them, right away. They should, however, be carefully watched to make sure that they don't choke on their own vomit. Only when the client is ready to get clean should they be offered towels, tissues, and assistance. Another form of releasing that involves material coming out of the mouth is the faucet. This also tends to show up immediately after someone takes a hit and may or may not eventually become a full purge of vomit, or might also just wane as the medicine subsides. Here, individuals open their mouths and saliva pours out at a rate that is similar to a lightly turned on water faucet. In such instances, the salivary glands are working overtime, and the experience is often accompanied by sensations of extreme nausea. Usually putting a bucket under the person's mouth is sufficient for managing the flow, and then, if they do eventually throw up, the bucket is there for them and helps keep things neat. Foaming at the mouth and spitting up thick, bubbly mucus is also common. This often occurs when people are lying down and the mucus tends to drip down their faces, necks, and might get into their ears. At times, this phenomenon can be accompanied by rapid body vibrations and tremors. It might look like they're having a seizure. They aren't. They're just processing energy and nothing needs to be done to or for them. Eventually, it will pass and they'll probably want to clean themselves up before proceeding with the session. This tends to show up when people are deep in the absorption phase of the experience and might even be experienced as a full-body orgasm, and despite appearances, can be quite pleasurable. After the absorption phase, when the ego starts to reassert itself, is a time where it is very common for people to feel deeply uncomfortable and nauseous, and this is one of the most common times for people to vomit and release. This is a basic reflection of the fact that most people's egos make them profoundly uncomfortable. They might have just had a beautiful and profoundly loving and open experience during the absorption phase, but now that the ego is coming back, the individual is feeling all the personal distortions, illusions, and attachments of the ego character, and it doesn't feel good. The patterns of the ego are attempting to reconfigure into standard patterns, and now the individual feels these as incompatible with the unconditional love with which they were just identified. So a need to release the patterns and the holdings they cause arises. Usually, but not always, at this point individuals have enough normal self-awareness to sit up and vomit into a receptacle. During this later phase of the experience, many people find themselves feeling the urge to purge and vomit, but are not able to do so. Sometimes people then try to induce vomiting. Such attempts are not proper technique and are an example of the ego attempting to do something to control the situation. The task of the one undergoing this therapy is always to relax, allow, and do nothing. Trying to make yourself vomit is just allowing the ego to get in the way and interfere with the natural process. There are two ways that such a situation could be addressed. The first is to open up to the sensation of nausea, breathing into it and literally opening the mouth and throat and sticking out the tongue, as though offering an invitation for the purge to proceed of its own accord. Often breathing deeply into the sensation and holding the breath until the vomit releases is effective, and then it comes right out. These can be difficult purges, however, because unlike the champagne cork, where the individual is passing into a state of universal love, during these later purges, the individual is struggling with encountering the distortions of the ego and regaining a sense of self. It can feel like the universe is turning inside out through the matrix of one's being, and there is a sense of being forcefully cleaned out with such intensity that it can be difficult to breathe. As always, relaxing fully into the experience and just allowing it to take place is the best advice. Also, contrary to many people's expectations and assumptions, if the purge is not releasing, this is a key time to take more medicine. The ego thinks, I just want to get the sensation under control before taking more, but the exact opposite approach is more effective. By taking more medicine, rather than trying to struggle with and suppress the nausea, you invite the possibility of a champagne cork release, or the possibility that a fresh hit of medicine will make the nausea dissipate without a release. In either case, taking more medicine immediately shifts the energy of the situation and allows it to transform into something else. And that, of course, this last sentence here, was the whole point of the event with the Jewish client who said, oh, we Jews have always suffered for God. And I said, don't bring that kind of bullshit into my house. And he said, oh, you're right, I'm full of shit. And then he purged, and then he moved into a different state, an ecstatic state of the experience. That's the point. The point is not anti-Semitism. It's about the ego is withholding and indulging in self-pity. And by calling the ego out on it, it's able to recognize that, and then it's able to release it, and then move on. That's a therapeutic process. And it works. It's not about being anti-anything. It's actually about being pro. Pro-universal love. Pro-release. Pro-transcendence. Okay, now that we've gotten that out of the way, we can talk a little bit about religion and spirituality. This is another section of my book, In Theogenic Liberation. Of course, kind of really started with my whole take on religion and spirituality. Started with my 2009 book, Being Human, An Entheological Guide to God, Evolution, and the Fractal Energetic Nature of Reality. So that's kind of where I started this take on religion and spirituality. But here's what I include in my 2017 book, In Theogenic Liberation. This comes on page 159. Religion and spirituality. And I think it's important to focus on this because, again, Symposia has wanted to paint me as being anti-Semitic. And, you know, actually, if we're being honest, I am anti-religion in general. So it doesn't have anything to do with being, quote-unquote, anti-Semitic. My position, which is made clear in my book, Being Human, and pretty much everything I've done since then, is that each human being is actually a direct embodiment of what I call God. So that, for me, that's what the sessions that I was doing with people was to help people reach that own state of realization within themselves. And by helping them to process this stuck energy and repressed energy of their ego in order to help clear them out so that they could open up to the full experience of being. You know, it's quite simple in that sense. Anyway, here's the section on religion and spirituality. As is hopefully clear by now, If you're still wondering which religion or spiritual practice you should follow to best assist yourself on your journey to freeing and loving yourself fully and without conditions, the answer is obvious: none. While there are some religious and spiritual practices and concepts that may be relevant for genuine non-dual liberation and being, there are no perfect fits. They all suffer from deficiencies due to ego projection and attachment. There is no such thing as a right religion or spiritual tradition. Overly dualistic religions are obviously way off the mark. Religions that promote belief in some kind of fundamental divide between God and humans or God and reality, the majority of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam falls into this category. But even supposedly non-dual traditions, such as some forms of Hinduism and Buddhism, are still lacking in clarity and are not free from ego projection, mainly because of their beliefs in individual reincarnation, karma, and dharma. Shamanism isn't any better, with its insistence on the reality of spirits, entities, and spiritual realms, and other forms of dualistic otherness. Lots of ego going on there, especially as neo-shamanism is often played out in contemporary Western cultures where beliefs, symbols, practices, and identities are appropriated and adopted from other traditional cultures. At best, different religions and spiritualities may contain select teachings and practices that are valid and genuine for non-dual enlightenment and liberation, but they're all infected with ego confusion, beliefs, doctrines, and individual and collective forms of identity and ego. Meditation programs can be great, for example, as they can help you learn how to be present and less victimized by your thoughts and reactions. But they're also indoctrinating you into beliefs about reincarnation and karma. They're deluding you and giving you more fuel for your ego illusions. Similarly, psychedelic shamanism may provide a good context for energetically working on yourself with powerful psychedelic medicines. But as soon as ritual and spirits and prayer get in there, you're being led astray from genuine non-duality and instead engaging in high-level ego projection and identity confusion. If it helps, think of it this way. Imagine that God were a human being. What form of religion or spirituality would this God-human participate in or feel drawn toward? None. What use would God have for religion or spirituality? Religion and spirituality are just for egos. The thing is, you are that God-human. This is who you truly are. It's what you've always been and what you'll always be, no matter how confused or lost you are. Because this is you, you have no real need for religion or spirituality. That's why the process, techniques, and experiences outlined in this book are described as a form of therapy and not as a religion or spiritual practice. If you ever do successfully liberate yourself from your self-created prison, you'll find that this is an obvious truth and there will be no need or desire to associate or identify with any religion or spirituality. It will just be obvious that these are just things for egos to do and don't really have any real role to play for liberated individuals. Freedom from the ego means freedom from all forms of religious and spiritual identity and practice. Simply being requires no religious belief and no spiritual practice whatsoever. So that's my view on the matter. Of course, anyone is welcome to disagree with that, but that's my view. So there's some more context for you. Okay, so the next little bit of context that I wanted to provide comes from the chapter starting on page 165 of Entheogenic Liberation. This is Being a Non-Dual Energetic Practitioner. I read the first paragraph in the podcast last week. I'm just going to repeat it now. And this is a 20-page chapter. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to go through a couple of the opening paragraphs here just to give you an idea of what's in there. And again, that this is kind of written from my perspective of having engaged in this kind of work with clients. And, you know, as is made clear in the very introduction to this chapter, that it's presented along the lines of sort of this is the free and open exchange of ideas and information, and that this is not necessarily provided as a map for anybody else to follow. It's just this is how it worked in my sessions, and also with the idea that probably other people wouldn't really be able to do this. Because my practice was very unique to me. And that's a point I'm going to return to a little bit later. Anyway, so to reiterate the first paragraph from this section, the chances that anyone reading this is qualified to be considered a full non-dual psychedelic therapy practitioner are slim. In order to be such, you must have gone through all the work detailed in this book and personally reached a point of liberation from your ego. You must both know yourself and have given yourself permission to be yourself at all times and in all situations. That's a high standard. So this section of the book is more an example of imaginative illustration, included here to inform readers of what such a practice looks like and what it entails, but with very little expectation that anyone will be able to directly implement it. However, this book is also written with the hope that a few brave and determined individuals may, in fact, reach the point where they could qualify as a genuine practitioner and not simply a provider. To restate, providers are people who present the opportunity to work with and experience medicine for others. Primarily, they are there to provide a safe and conducive environment for their clients. In addition to making the medicine experience available, they are largely concerned with holding space during the experience and may also provide some coaching during the experience, encouraging people to relax, trust, let go, etc. This can all be done neutrally, without any use of ritual, ceremony, chant, prayer, or other forms of imaginary sacred activity. However, many providers choose to implement such techniques, seeing it as a legitimate route to augmenting their own role in the proceedings, or perhaps as a method of appeasing the expectations of their clients. Such activities are not needed, however, and can be an area for ego attachment and projection. Any provider who makes a big deal about putting on an elaborate show of ritual and ceremony has ego attachments at play and is performing a self-created role rather than simply being present in authenticity. As a practitioner, your primary role is to help clients directly through the energy of the experience, work with them every step along the way, and ensure that they reach a point of completion within their session so that they emerge grounded in reality. While there is some coaching involved, this is minor compared to the direct energy work and processing that is required, which is the bulk of what you are there to do. Every client in every session will have some big form of energy processing that needs to take place, and it will vary for different clients and even for the same client on different days. You are there to help them move through the process of releasing stuck and distorted energy, become self-aware of ongoing ego patterns, illusions, projections, distortions, and attachments, and to assist them in making direct progress toward their own liberation and embodied presence. You are not there to hold space. You are there to work, and your assistance is vital and deeply intimate to your client's experiences. Before starting to work with anyone, make it clear to your potential clients that you are not a medicine provider. If they are simply looking for an opportunity to experience the medicine themselves, you can inform them that this is not your role and that they will need to find someone else. If they want to work directly on their liberation, you are a good choice, but if not, they should look elsewhere for a provider. It's as if you are a massage therapist, but someone just wanted to come over and use your mat or massage table and oils, but not have you work on them or apply your skills, and instead insisted on doing everything themselves. It would be a waste of everyone's time, and quite odd as well. In fact, getting a massage is a good metaphor for the medicine work, and you might note the similarity of such to your potential clients. When you go to get a massage, your job is to relax, surrender, and let the massage therapist do his or her work. It is not your job to massage yourself or the massage therapist. The more you relax, the more you'll get out of the massage. And while you may have an idea of areas on which you think you need work, you can trust the massage therapist to find such places based on how you feel energetically, how you react to their touch, and what kinds of movements of energy take place during the session. And, as when getting a massage, if you encounter stuck or blocked energy, the process of breaking it up and moving it out can be painful and challenging. But your job as the one receiving the massage is to relax and breathe into the pain and difficulty and let the work proceed without reacting or interfering. The more you can do this, the more you'll get out of the session. And similarly, when it's all over, you'll most likely feel worked over and might be sore and sensitive for a few days afterwards. So, you know, that's kind of setting up the context of what it's about. And then, you know, the next 20 pages kind of go into more detail. And all of this, you know, these were things that I shared with my clients prior to doing any kind of work with them. You know, I did my best to fully inform clients about what would be involved, what the different potential interactions would be like, and really what the whole process looks like. That was a very large concern for me, that I wanted people to be as informed as possible. Now, one last section of the book that I'm just going to mention here that I think is worthwhile because, of course, Symposia is kind of fixated on this idea of sexual abuse. Now, I've talked about this before, and I'm just going to iterate again, that while there were times where clients themselves became sexual, my involvement with them was never sexual. And that my work was not a model for doing any kind of sexual contact or therapy with clients. But I do have a section of my book. There is a chapter that is titled Couples Work, Relationships, and Sexuality. And, you know, just for the record, I just want to state that this chapter, the information in this chapter, really comes from the work that my wife and I did together. This was not between me and other clients. This was between myself and my wife. And, you know, kind of learned a lot of interesting things there. So that's what's being shared in this chapter. And also based on the fact that it was often the case that clients that I worked with, that their partner would come and also get a session from me, but I would work with each person individually, and that there are certain dynamics that might occur within relationships while doing this work that I think is relevant to mention. So that's why it's in the book. So I don't think I really have much more to say about any of this at this point. I will say again that I have invited anyone who feels that they have an issue from a session that they did with me to contact me directly so that we could talk about it. I have not heard from anyone directly. I have heard from a number of people saying that they really appreciated their sessions with me and were grateful for that. And we're sorry to see how Symposia is choosing to characterize all of this. But I haven't heard from anyone who actually has a negative comment directly. And I've also invited anyone who has a serious issue or question that they'd like me to address just to, you know, message me directly. Don't leave it on a comment on Facebook or on social media, but contact me directly. And I do have one of those. And so this comes from Mateo, and he shares in the message, he shares some experiences that he's had in serving medicine with other people and some people that he's encountered who have been influenced by my work. And so he has what I think is, you know, it's a legitimate question that what he's asking, you know, he wrote me a nice long message there, and it comes down to is this here. He says, do you think there's anything to address from your part regarding the topic of ethics and or responsibility as an author? And this kind of comes at the end of his message. And he talks about some people that he's encountered that he feels were kind of imitating me in some way or another. You know, having watched videos of me or listened to me talk, that people saying things that I say or behaving in a way that I behaved or, for example. So what is the responsibility of me? And I think that that's a good question. You know, the way that I have thought of my work and what I've shared with people is sharing what I can to help people learn how to really authentically be themselves. And this is something that no one can do for you. And, you know, I've learned a lot through my own experiences and through my own practice. And I've tried to share that as the open and free exchange of information and ideas so that people can have something of a map and some guidelines and some guideposts for how they can do it themselves. And within all of this, it has never been my intention to have people, quote unquote, be like me. What I would like to see is for people to fully be themselves, and merely imitating me is definitely not going to do that. I mean, everybody's got to find their own way to be themselves and embody their own energy authentically. And So yeah, I've shared this information and there's a potential that people could use it and try these techniques and practices on another person. And you know, the question is, well, are they qualified to do it? And that's not a question that I can answer. I've not trained anyone in this. I actually don't think that it's something that can be taught or learned. It really has to be discovered within yourself. And it really is everyone's personal responsibility to be their own check and balance on their own authenticity. So, you know, I mean, I can say this, I can write this, like I mentioned before, that at the very beginning of my book, all right, this work is for educational purposes. Readers are fully responsible for their own choices and actions. But if people are imitating me, then perhaps I bear responsibility for that. I don't really know the answer to that, because also it's not like I'm out there supervising people. I'm not getting this information, you know, it's something that, for example, was kind of filtered through Mateo's email to me about him discussing his own experiences. But yeah, that is, I think it's always a question of when you're putting out information that is radical, different, and challenging, that, you know, other people might use that and implement that, and you know, they might not really be qualified to do that. But I don't know how much responsibility I can take for what other people are doing. And again, I guess what I would just really want to say here is I want to encourage everyone to be themselves. Don't try to be me. Be yourself. And this also goes for anybody who is serving medicine in whatever way they want to do it. You know, I have shared this was my way. And everybody else, they've got to find their own way. And if they find my guidelines useful and helpful, certainly an area that I can say that seems to be quite productive is not necessarily with people who are looking to serve medicine to other people under this model that I have provided here. But I get many, 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 many messages from people saying that they've applied this for themselves in their own sessions with themselves and have found it to be truly transformative and really spot on. So I think that needs to be balanced with any kind of, well, people are imitating Martin and, you know, maybe they're not doing it right or they're being intrusive in some way. That in sharing this information, I received a lot of feedback from people saying that it helped them. And I haven't actually received any information from people saying that I applied your guidelines and it hurt me. I have not personally received that. So that's what I have to go off. Just like when discussing the context of my sessions themselves that I held with people, that no one has actually come to me to say, hey, I really didn't like that, or I felt violated in some way. That the feedback that I got from my clients was overwhelmingly positive and grateful. So that's what I have. But I think it's a good question, Mateo. And, you know, it's something that I'm open to exploring further. So I think that's really all that I have for now. Again, I will mention that this panel presentation or talk or whatever it's going to be with Symposia should be coming up sometime soon. I will do my best to inform the public of when that will be taking place and how you can participate or watch or listen. And probably next week I will put out the interview with Rob here on the podcast, which again just might be a repeat for some of you because maybe you've already watched that interview or listened to that interview. But I want it here on the podcast anyway. And I'll see, maybe next week I'll have something else to say because maybe the presentation or the panel presentation with Symposia will have taken place by then. And I might have more additional responses. But at the moment I'm feeling like, well, I've really said all that I can say about it. So I'm going to leave it there for now. Thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. And talk to you next week. All right. Bye.